Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Banter on the Parkway. I am your host, Brian, from bannersontheparkway.com. I'm joined, as always, by the man that they call Arjen Robin, except his left foot sucks too. It's Brad. Brad, how you doing?
I'm not doing too badly. I will cop to not having a great left foot, but my right foot is comparable to Arjen Robin's, which he basically uses just for standing on.
Right. It's a bit of a Ricardo Quaresma situation, really, except you're a lot closer to Arjen Robin in the hair department, I gotta say.
That's true. And I think starting off with a mildly obscure reference and then swerving into an extremely obscure reference about a footballer last playing in Istanbul is a great way to kick off our basketball podcast, too.
I know. The people need to know. Ricardo Quaresma, he's a hero of mine because he doesn't work that hard. But he seems to have fun. And speaking of people who seem to have a lot of fun, it's Braden also joining us. Braden, how's it going? And Braden,
I'm a podcast, and I don't call soccer players footballers.
Okay. You're going to have to get a little quicker on that unmute button, buddy. All right. Well, it's January, which means I'm miserable because not only does this month suck, but also February is coming up and it sucks even worse. So I'm just going to ignore the fact that we still have 17 days of this crap fest to go in all of February and skip straight to March because the NCAA has confirmed that March Madness is going to be taking place in one location this year. From what I've read, they're going to be holding the entire tournament in Indianapolis, and that's going to hopefully give the teams a chance to bubble up and not have the chopping and changing of the schedule like we've experienced in the regular season with one team testing positive or the, you know, and then their opponent having to either try and find a game or, as is the case with Xavier this week, just not playing for a week, as has been the case with Xavier a lot lately. So, Brad, how is that going to change the schedule of March Madness? And most importantly, am I still going to be able to sit on Joel's couch and just nail a ton of farts into it because I'm sitting there eating chicken wings and watching basketball on a Thursday afternoon?
I don't know about the Thursday afternoon part and whether his long-suffering wife is going to invite us all over. I'm not entirely certain. I'm hoping so. I'm sure we'll be together. Like you said, it's all going to be played in Indianapolis at six different locations, one of which is Hinkle Fieldhouse. So get ready for just a month-long hagiography of Butler. There's three things that the NCAA has options on here. One is just staying with the usual schedule that we all know and quite frankly love. Selection Sunday is going to be March 14th, no matter what, they have announced that. What they do after that is what's up to change. They could play just the usual schedule. That means the first four games would start on Tuesday, or the playing games, however you want to quantify those, and then the regular games would start Thursday, Friday, and off we would go. The other thing could be a full week wait, so teams have a chance to bubble. And by full week wait, I mean then that the first four of the play-ins start the next Tuesday, so push everything back. Teams have a chance to bubble up. You make sure you're not going to get any surprise COVID tests or anything like that. Everybody's ready to go. Hopefully they can all stay safe. You can get the whole tournament in. The third option is a hybrid of that, and this is the one that Matt Norlander said that NCAA is kicking around. Since he's with CBS and they're the home of the tournament, I'm assuming he's probably got pretty good information. It's a little confusing. The automatic qualifying teams would get into Indianapolis before Selection Sunday. So the AQs that know they're going to be there would transfer all their stuff. They would come in early. I'm sure they'll bring all their homework because these are student athletes, as we'll be reminded a lot of times. They'll get into Indianapolis, bubble up, and wait. The remaining teams then would come in on Monday. That'll be March 15th after they find out they've been selected. Everybody quarantines then until March 19th. So that's Friday when the tournament usually is in its second day. Those would be the play-in games. Saturday and Sunday, the 20th and 21st, would then be the first set of big bracket games. So the first set of games then would be Saturday and Sunday rather than being Thursday, Friday. The teams would then play again Monday and Tuesday, take Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday off. That would also leave those slates open, those days open in case you have makeup games or if something goes bad, you've got time. And then roll right into the next Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday would be Sweet 16 and Elite 8. So kind of looking at staggering the tournament back a couple days of how it normally is. I don't know how much I like that idea, but I do like the idea of getting the tournament in this year. So whatever they have to do, those are the three things they're basically looking at. The usual schedule, a full, I guess it would be like a 9-day selection Sunday start, or this kind of hybrid where they start on the weekend.
Interesting. And how much do you think this is driven by the idea that people were unhappy to be playing at UD Arena because it sucks? And so now they're going to make them go play at Hinkle Fieldhouse, which sucks even worse, so that next year people will be happy again to be at UD Arena.
I think that's definitely a really good possibility. At least UD Arena has running water. I was there a couple years ago and can attest that I was able to both get a drink of water and wash my hands there. So that puts it up one step from the barn.
What is the clock situation there? Does time, you know, have the relativistic bend there? we're getting way into the weeds on this. But the fact of the matter is Hinkle Fieldhouse sucks, and so does Butler's program. Speaking of things that did not suck, Xavier was in action this week. They played on Sunday at an 11 a.m. tip, which was weird. And they were able to come away with a 74-73 victory over the Providence Friars. So, Braden, what did we learn about Xavier in this game as they once again unearthed the age-old question, is Edward Cooley a good basketball coach?
What we learned was that we can actually still play offense. It was good to see the ball moving again. We had 20 assists on our field goals in this particular game. So the ball was moving. We averaged over a point per possession in this game. The threes were better than they had been, 8 of 23. It's not setting the world on fire, but it's not terrible. Our free throws, we learned we are just garbage at those. I don't know if we learned that or if we're just still coming to grips with it. But we shot 8 of 16 from the line, and Providence, God bless them, they shot 2 of 6, somehow worse. But yeah, that was something that towards the end of the game, I'd have been a lot less nervous with about a minute to go if we'd maybe shot, you know, badly from the line, would have been an improvement. But we did learn, though, that the team was able to dig deep at the end, 73-66 with just over a minute to go after we pretty terribly shot ourselves in the foot. So it was good to see us stick with it. Nate Johnson hit a three. We got a jumper from Fremantle. And then obviously Colby Jones knocks down that three for the win at the end of the game. So it was good to see that we were able to just dig in there, get the big win, because we'd have been staring down a really rough stretch of games if we dropped this one.
Yeah, unlike Braden, I wasn't nervous with a minute to play. I was mostly angry because it seemed like we were bound and determined to lose that game no matter how we had to do it. We were just going to persevere through and lose it. There were a lot of people complaining about turnovers. Xavier really took care of the ball pretty well with the exception of Zach Fremantle. Xavier turned the ball over 13 times and he had 6 of them. I don't know what's going on with Fremantle. It was huge to see him knock down that jumper. Not necessarily the shot I would have liked to get, but he got it, made it, and that ended up propelling us towards the win. But he's got to get things fixed. Offensively, when he's not throwing the ball away, he's still doing well. He had two assists. He scored 17 points. He grabbed three offensive boards. It was a nice game from him, except for the fact that, you know, almost half the time he touched it, he was punting it to somebody on their team. That'll lower your offensive rating pretty significantly. And when he is, I don't know if he's Xavier's best offensive player. We've discussed this before. He's certainly the linchpin of the offense, though. They're going to run through him. They're going to work offense through him. We can't work offense through him if he keeps turning our offense into defense.
Yeah, just to quickly offer a correction here, because we take very seriously our journalistic integrity and we want to get the facts right. According to Providence's website, Ed Cooley's full name is just Ed Cooley. He doesn't apparently even have a middle name. So that's odd, but you know what? Good for you, Ed. Yeah, Fremantle, though, I think he played better toward the end of the game. For a long while, it looked like he was really struggling in the post against Nate Watson, who came into this game. Actually, I looked it up. He's the all-time Big East career leader in getting dunked on by Jason Carter. And he was not able to add to that. So, you know, when you go to the ballpark and you watch Hank Aaron play, you would expect him to hit a homer, even though he doesn't do it every time. But, you know, the hammer and Hank of getting it punched on you by Jason Carter wasn't able to come up with one this game. So you got to wonder about Nate Watson. But Fremantle, toward the end of the game, I noticed he started running the floor really, really well. And that was one of the things he really did well last season. There was that game against UConn where he was all over the place. He, of course, had that one sequence where he ran back and blocked a shot and then led the fast break to the other end of the floor and scored the basket at that end. And that kind of emphasized how quickly he gets up and down the floor for a big man. And that's what he started doing a lot better toward the end of this game. And it really helped Xavier for him to be able to capitalize on some fast breaks, because once he gets out on the break, he usually does really well around the hoop. He has some nice moves to get the defender to go past him and then finish. So I thought that was a switch he made that gave me some hope that he can find his way out of the little funk he's in. I was very impressed, though, really, by the contribution of all the freshmen. Jones obviously got the headlines, as well he should have. He hit the biggest shot of the game. Odom, I thought, played well. He had three assists and no turnovers and continues to just be a really good initiator for Xavier's offense. And I think he helps a lot more than maybe people give him credit for, because his stats aren't eye-popping. He only had 3 points. He had one board, but he had the three assists, no turnovers, two steals. I think, though, that he helps in that Xavier's other guards know that he's going to get into the lane, draw the defense, and be looking for them. He's not a guy who hunts his own shots a lot. And then CJ Wilcher, really, for I think the first time, at least in Big East play, came in and made his impact on the game. He had 6 points in 6 minutes. You can't ask for a lot more than that. Coach Steele has been praising him this week about his effort in practice. Obviously, the rotation's going to be a little different now with Ben Stanley out for the year, and so he did a good job of seizing his opportunity there. So yeah, I thought all three freshmen really looked good. Brad, what is going on with Xavier's free throw shooting, though?
It's not very good. I know you're looking for an in-depth answer, and I've got one for you. Part of the thing is that Xavier has always been a team that gets to the line a lot. Skip Prosser said he wanted to make more free throws than the other team took. And for a long time, Xavier did that. They aren't this year. Xavier's free throw rate is 28.4%. That's 246th in the nation. And when you're talking about some teams that hardly played at all, that's way down near the bottom. Their mark from the line is 223rd in the nation. They're at 68.6%. It's just, that's not very good free throw shooting. They're not getting there a lot. They're not converting when they do get there. Some of that is that the game has changed. It's pace and space now. Everybody knows not to foul a jump shooter, and Xavier is predominantly a jump shooting team. they shoot more three-pointers now than they have at any point in time since Sean Miller's third season. They lift a lot. You don't get fouled when you're shooting three-pointers. That's just kind of how things go. So they end up not getting to the line. They don't get to the line, so they don't get easy points. That's kind of the thing that is keeping this offense from really being elite. They shoot the ball relatively well. Their three-point percentage is 35%. It's not great, but it's not really weighing them down. They're solid inside the arc. They don't turn the ball over very much at all, actually. 64th in the nation in turnover rate is definitely good enough to take you places. Their effective field goal percentage is 41st in the nation. They just don't get to the line very much. And frankly, I don't see that changing a whole lot because they don't have a team that is built on players who get fouled and get to the line. Brian Griffin has the highest free throw rate on the team, but he doesn't play a whole ton. You got Zach Fremantle, who is more of an athletic move around, shoot it type of big, as opposed to somebody who gets down into the paint and gets wailed on by opposing players type of big. Xavier's two guards that you would expect to get to the rim, Dwan Odom and Kiki Tandy. Odom has been hampered by COVID and missing time with that, and is still just trying to find his place in the offense. And Tandy is shooting so badly inside the arc that there's really no reason to foul him. His shooting percentage inside the three-point stripe is 39%. When he gets all the way to the rim, his shooting percentage is just a hair over 30%. That's terrible. There's no reason really for anybody to foul him. That has affected his confidence in going to the rim. So all that leads to a Xavier team that just doesn't shoot very many free throws. And when they do shoot them, they don't make them. Kind of the chief person at fault there, I guess, would be Jason Carter. He's only making 60% of the 30 he's taken. Paul Scruggs is shooting them well, but Zach Fremantle's not either. And like I said, people just don't get there very often. And because of that, the team is missing out on a lot of really easy points that would, like Braden said, have helped calm everybody's nerves with a minute to play against Providence.
To speak to your point a bit about free throw rate, Xavier's is 28.4 this season. And I looked it up, the free throw rate in the Big East this season is 28.1. So Xavier actually for the season now obviously in Big East, not all their games have been in Big East play, but in Big East games, Xavier's free throw rate for the season is actually above average, which I think speaks to the quality of officiating in the Big East, to be quite honest, because unless it's some stupid touch foul, they pretty much don't call anything anymore. Unless it's like a hand check 45 feet from the basket or a technical for something dumb. But yeah, so it seems like that's the way the game's going a bit, is that the referees just aren't calling some of the things that maybe they called in previous seasons, or are calling some things they didn't call in previous seasons. I don't know. But the free throw weight in the Big East is super low this year, is my point. Braden, speaking of the Big East, what are some notable Big East scores from this week?
Well, we got a couple nice scores this week. The first one was St. John 69, Butler 57. You can feel free to say nice right now. Nice. Yes. The big story coming out of this, for St. John's, Julian Champagny, who we've all talked about is going to be a handful this year. He went for 18 points on 50% shooting, was 2 of 2 from the line, and he pulled in 5 boards, had an assist, 2 blocks, 2 steals. The guy is really an all-around force, and I think for St. John's this year, he's really going to need to be going if they're going to upset some of the teams towards the top. They did do a good job of speeding this game up for Butler a little bit. They forced 16 turnovers. Butler was only able to get 13 assists. They shot 5 of 10 from the line and 6 of 24 from 3. So St. John's really forced them to take worse shots. And I don't know if they forced them to shoot badly from the line, but whatever they did, it worked because they sucked from there. But the other game was also a very nice score line. It was Marquette 79, Providence 69. You can go ahead.
Whoa, double nice. Holy cow.
Yeah, this might be the greatest week in Big East history. I mean, we get a buzzer beater for X and then 269 scores on Tuesday night. Like, this is incredible.
I'm honest. I absolutely love it.
I'm loving it too. For Marquette though, Dawson Garcia had a really good game. He went for 20 points, had 6 boards. 4 of those were offensive boards. Providence isn't really a great defensive rebounding team, but he was in there going at Nate Watson, and he was able to get some stick backs off of that. He had a really good game. Kobe McEwen went for 17. He had 8 boards to go with that and 5 assists with no turnovers. For Providence, obviously they're going to need David Duke to be excellent if they're really going to have a chance this year. He went for 17 points. He shot 3 of 14 inside the arc, though. 2 of 4 from 3, 5 of 6 from the line. He did have 9 assists with only 1 turnover, but he was pulling a lot, and it just kind of wasn't his night from inside the arc. Nate Watson was doing Nate Watson things. He had 18 points. Only 3 boards, but he did shoot 4 of 4 from the line, which is kind of a surprise for him. But yeah, apart from their scoreline, Providence didn't really have anything nice going for him in this game. And ultimately, Marquette just had the extra firepower with Garcia, McEwen, and DJ Carton chipping in 13. So they ultimately were just able to get this one across the line.
I think Providence is the team that is going to be hanging right on the bubble in the Big East this year, like Xavier was last year. They don't seem to have quite enough firepower to shoot themselves up above it, but they're also not quite bad enough that they have no chance, like say DePaul, who's DePauling their way towards last in the Big East again. I think the other big piece of Big East news, I don't know if you guys have even seen it yet, is that James Bouknight is out indefinitely after having left elbow surgery. There is no timetable for his return. It's not looking good. A lot of talk he could be done for the year, but he's definitely done for a significant amount of time. Connecticut is having a great year back in the Big East. They're 7-1. They're 22nd in the Ken Pom. They look good, but a lot of that is because of Bouknight, and they've just lost him for the foreseeable.
Another piece of Big East news is that Jalen Butts has announced he's transferring from DePaul. He had not played yet this year. To be honest, unless I saw the box scores, I was unaware of any games DePaul's played this year because they just so routinely get beaten. It's not even worth paying attention to. But it is notable because Jalen Butts punched it super hard on Sean McDermott last year. So, you know, you will be missed, Jalen. Jared Roden, please stay. Please stay forever. Starting a petition to get Jared Roden indefinite eligibility in the Big East, as long as he keeps dunking on Butler. So anyway, Brad, you went a little bit into Kiki Tandy's travails so far this year, but what does he need to do to get back in the rotation? It just seems like he and Adam Kunkel kind of fill a similar role, and Kunkel is filling it very well right now.
Kiki has got to come up with a big game. He's going to have the chance to get out there, and when he does, he's going to have to make himself look like he's a part of the offense that cannot be left out. And the problem with Kiki is that he's just not very good defensively. He has slow feet, and he gets beat on the perimeter too much. Like you said, he and Adam Kunkel kind of fill the same role. The thing is, Adam Kunkel has really taken to that role with kind of a swashbuckling flair. I love watching that dude play. I'm not sure how many other people in the nation, with time running down and your team down, would decide that right then was the time to attempt a leaping two-handed overhand pass. But Kunkel did it, and it didn't look like he even had a second thought about it. He then ran out to the corner, and I don't know how much you've watched Colby Jones's winner and seen people other than Colby Jones, but Kunkel was frantically calling for the ball. Like, I mean, he wants the rock at all times. He makes things happen with it. He's very aggressive. He's a surprisingly good defender. I hadn't heard about that part of his game, but he does pretty well, even in man on offense. I mean, on defense, he's not getting lost real often. He's doing a good job. It seems like he has seized the opportunity, and Kiki has shrunk from it a little bit. When Tandy gets out there, he just looks tentative. He's calling to mind some of the worst traits of Quentin Gooden, in that he's not using the skill set that he has to beat his man off the dribble or to get into the lane and do what Tu Holloway was so good at, of keeping his dribble alive in the lane and making defenses react to him. What it seems like Dwan Odom is good at is that same thing, getting into the lane and making things happen. Tandy seems a lot more content to stand outside and let shots come to him. To his credit, he is a good three-point shooter. He's been doing well there this year. He also does well on the occasions he hits the line. He's 18 of 22 from the line. The problem is there are other guys on Xavier who can do those things. Nate Johnson certainly fills the role of spot-up shooter. Adam Kunkel is going to be a spot-up shooter. It would be nice if he started becoming a spot-up maker as well. But Paul Scruggs is shooting well. Dwan Odom is doing a good job running the offense. Paul Scruggs has been spelling him there. Kiki hasn't really forced a place where he can find like the little niche thing that he's going to do well to make himself indispensable to the team. The things that he does well, other people are doing well right now who maybe bring something else elsewhere. He's got to find a way to get himself out there, because I think, as the last game showed, he's slipping out of the rotation. And I frankly can't blame Coach Steele for that. At this point in time, especially with C.J. Wilcher stepping up, if he continues to develop the shot that he's supposed to, do you guys see something that Kiki does better than anybody else that Barrett?
I think it's like you said, he seems a little bit tentative right now. And I think it's because of the fact that it's probably a bit of chicken and an egg situation. He quit getting quite as much game time as he was at the start of the year when Jones and Wilcher and Kunkel weren't eligible. And then because of that, he maybe started pressing a little bit. He started trying not to make mistakes. I just think he needs to get aggressive again. I think he's a really good player. I think when he puts the ball on the floor, he can make things happen. But even when he does that, it seems like, especially against St. John's, he was a little tentative to try and really get that far into the lane. He was settling for floaters, and St. John's had enough length that they were able to affect those. So I still think that he has something to offer this team, but he certainly looks like he's a little bit short on just, you know, he seems uncomfortable right now. And also, when you talk about Xavier guards who get in the lane and make things happen, I can't believe you left out D. Davis. I can't. Unbelievable. Joel is going to call in. We don't even accept callers on this show, and he's calling my phone right now to rage at you about this oversight. So anyway, all right. Now here's a thing that happens. I guess it was the Marquette game maybe last night. Yeah, Marquette. Their coach actually slapped the floor, which is a ridiculous thing for a coach to do. It's also a ridiculous thing for a basketball player to do. So we ask for your thoughts on floor slapping. Daniel got in touch. Daniel said, yes, I've slapped the floor. It was stupid and I regret it. It hurt and it just ticked off the guy I was guarding. Did you guys ever slap the floor playing basketball? Brayden, we'll go ahead and start with you because it's been so long since Brad played competitive basketball. He probably needs to like go find a photo album and be like, oh yeah, that. So go ahead.
No, I never slapped the floor because I knew the rule was you slap the floor on defense, you're about to get scored on. And most of the time, the guy that I was guarding didn't really need any help because I was guarding him. So, yeah, slapping the floor wasn't something in my repertoire. I don't have the flexibility or the arm length to even get my hands down there for a nice firm slap. I might graze it with my fingertips, but that's about all I'm getting. So, no, floor slapping was not my thing.
I would only consider slapping the floor when we were playing open gym with a bunch of your friends. I think it's acceptable then if everybody's just goofing around. that's a fine time to do it just to be funny. You are going to get scored on because you can't bend all the way over and touch the floor while you're trying to guard someone without them running past you. It's just physics. It's absolutely absurd to do that in a competitive game, and you deserve any bad thing that may happen to you. That originated at Duke, where obviously it was a way to show up your opponent. That's all it is. There is absolutely no basketball reason to ever slap the floor. It's just to get out there and be a wank. Like I said, it originated at Duke, where that is kind of, I think that's actually the university's motto. Get out there and be a wank. I'm not certain. I'm not entirely sure. I think that's it. It's a bad look. But you don't need to do it. It doesn't help anything. It just makes you look like you're one of those invariably white guys who thinks he's a great defender and has something to bring to the game. And now here you are, you know, storming onto the battlefield at Troy to face Achilles, and you must announce yourself by slapping the floor. Hector didn't do that. You don't need to do that. Just go play basketball.
I'd also like to point out Hector got killed, so maybe don't do what Hector did in that story. Also, Brad, what do you know about being a good on-ball defender? I don't really feel as though the listeners need to be taking tips from you in this category, but, you know, that's just me.
That was my one enduring basketball skill, actually. Now, Grant, that you were in a car seat, so probably didn't get to take that in very much during my last competitive games, but that was the one thing I could do well. I will say just a quick anecdote. I got to college having been the athletic guy in high school. I could dunk and run, and I'm like, this will be fun. And I first went to an open gym to play with a team I was going to play with in college, and the athletic guy who could only dunk and run and not shoot on that college team was coming down the floor at me, and I thought I'd impress the coach by taking a charge. And the next thing I heard was the rim rebounding, because he had leapt clean over me and dunked it and was running the other way. As hoots of derision landed in my ears. And that was when I realized that college and high school are way, way different.
Yeah, I was never into floor slapping because I was never into defense. It's for weaklings. You know, there are two phases of a basketball game. There's offense and waiting for the other team to give you the ball back. And so I would, I'd keep my hands off the floor. I need those to shoot. So, that was my take on slapping the floor. But I did have people slap the floor when guarding me, which was funny because I wasn't going to dribble past you anyway, but, that's neither here nor there. We do have a couple of other questions. Daniel wants to know on Fremantle's turnovers, is it that the Big East has figured him out, or is he just needing to adjust and, you know, is he just going through a bit of a slump? So, Braden, what have you seen? Is it have teams made an adjustment on Zach Fremantle, or is he just, you know, in a bit of a snag right now, which happens to basically every player?
I think it could be a little bit of both. Teams doing their scouting will obviously know that he's a big part of our offense and we like to play through him. So it would be about right if they key in on him and try to force him into turnovers like Providence did. I mean, he had 6 turnovers. That's way too many. But also, I mean, he is just in his sophomore season. And when he's got that much of kind of a burden on offense, he might be trying to press a little bit out there. He's had some games where he looks like he's trying to do maybe a little too much. Other games, he's not really doing enough. And then when he finds his sweet spot, he's just about unguardable. But I think it could be teams keying in on him. I mean, he'll have bad games. 6 turnovers is obviously a bad game. But I think he's got enough skill and a really good work ethic. I think he'll get out of it. And, I mean, we'll see him have some really big games coming up here.
I think they have made a notable adjustment. Like you said, Providence keyed in on him. One thing that Fremantle likes to do is shoot that mid-range jumper or even step farther out. That's a big part of his game. One thing he's less adept at is putting the ball on the floor and getting past people, which is no knock on him. He's a 6'9 power forward. They don't usually do a lot of dribbling. Defenses are tightening up on him when he catches the ball now and taking away that quick shot or taking away his jumper and making him try to put it on the floor and do something with it. I think that is what has led to a little bit of the turnover problem, is that that is not playing to his strength. You look at the last set then that Xavier ran to get him that shot, it did play to one of his strengths. Steele ran, I believe it was a pin down screen to get him coming up to the free throw line to get him a look where the defender wouldn't be right on him. And sure enough, he knocked it down. But teams are going to try to hug right up on him on the catch to make him dribble rather than make him shoot when he's out away from the rim. And that is going to be where he needs to make the adjustment, because I think that is where the Big East is adjusting to him a little bit. Like Braden said, though, I think he works his way out of it. I think one thing that Coach Steele has clearly demonstrated is that he can game plan offensively when he has pieces to work with. So I also expect that he'll continue to do things to get Zach his look.
All right, and then a couple questions from Bubba Cody. One being, what is the likelihood that Daniel Ramsey plays this year? And honestly, I don't know. I don't know that anybody but the Xavier coaching staff and training staff knows. We know he's been cleared, but beyond that, there's not a lot of information publicly available. It would certainly be nice to see him get out there, maybe mop up some minutes and, you know, garbage time against DePaul when we blow them out. But yeah, to be honest, I don't really know what the likelihood is. And then the second question is, why was Colby Jones out for the last 12 minutes when he's one of the better defenders at the 1, 2, and 3 positions? So Brad, what did you see in Xavier's rotation Sunday? Was there an opportunity to get Colby Jones in earlier? Obviously, Coach Steele got him in time to make the biggest shot of the game. So he was there in time to save the game. But what did you see in the rotation Sunday that led to Colby having such a long break?
I'm not entirely certain, honestly. I think it's a little bit hard to figure, because he is a young man who had just lost somebody very close to him, his grandfather, 2 days beforehand. It's hard to know how that might have been affecting him through the game. I'm not going to sit here and say it was or that's the reason or anything, but I do think that's a possibility. I also think it's got to be tough, especially now when practice is over and everything. I just feel for the young man being away from home with COVID going on and everything, and he's lost his grandfather. That's kind of beside the point. As to why the rotation was how it was, I don't know. Colby Jones is a good defender. He's a good guy to have out there. He can score. It could have been just a rest thing, wanting to keep him fresh, you know, so he can knock down game winners and things like that. Maybe he told Travis Steele, "Hey, I've got about 17 seconds left in my legs." And Steele was like, "Well, I know when I'm going to use those then." You know, he is a freshman. He ended up playing 22 minutes. So prior to that 12-minute run, he'd been out there for a long time. Adam Kunkel also found something and was doing well. Xavier was doing okay in the game, then all of a sudden went down 7. So it's not like Providence had been burying them during this time that Jones was out and there was this big glaring what is happening here. It was kind of back and forth, and then a quick run from Providence that put X into that trouble. As far as the rotations go, I wish I could tell Bubba Cody this is exactly why that happened, but I would suspect it had something to do with kind of his mental state, as well as how well Kunkel was playing and helping facilitate.
Yeah, I think Odom played pretty well during that stretch too. Braden, what did you have? Sorry.
I think personally, I think it was a masterclass from Steele there, because clearly I think the reason he had him sit out for 12 minutes was so that the other team would forget that he existed. And it worked, because Greg Gant completely forgot that Jones was on the floor and allowed him to get out to the 3-point line to hit the game winner. So I think that was just, I don't think there was any sort of question or mistake there. I just think that was next level coaching from Steele.
And I typed up another breaking down a game winner. I love watching game film. You guys both know that, of the Jones make, and what Greg Gantt's defense on that possession is appalling. He stands. The other four Providence guys really do a great job of playing defense, especially the guy who's on Nate Johnson does an excellent job showing a hand worth of help on Kunkel's drive and staying out on Johnson. Greg Gantt is literally flat-footed at the free throw line, like, wow, I've got a great view of everything that's happening right now. And by the time it finally clicks to him that he's supposed to be moving, he's been stationary for almost 3.5 seconds during a basketball game and then runs out to try to get to Paul Scruggs. And by then it is just way too late. But I don't know. Maybe you're right, Braden. Maybe he just completely forgot that Colby Jones was a thing that existed and thought that they were playing 4-on-5 or something, because he stands flat-footed at the free throw line and watches the ball bounce around. It's almost fascinating.
Yeah, I want to give Coach Steele actually a little more credit. I think he knew we'd need three right at the end, and with 12 minutes left in the game, sat Colby down and was like, okay, study this play. This is what we're running with you know, time waning to get you the game-winning shot. And Colby, you know, had to memorize it so that he could be in the right place at the right time, is what I think was likely the case. No, I think Dwan Odom played really well during that stretch. You want Scruggs out there during that stretch because he's Paul Scruggs, and you don't bench him with the game on the line. And then I think Kunkel was really adding a lot, even though his shot wasn't falling. He did really well as far as distributing the ball. And when you have a guy like Nate Johnson who fills in the gaps there, it can be easy, you know, for a guard to find himself, you know, sitting for quite a while. So I don't know that it was necessarily an error that Jones was out. I mean, the way that Providence shot the ball in the second half is super uncharacteristic of them. They were 7 of 11 from three in the second half. They shoot 28% from three. It's not like there were defensive lapses. They were just shooting out of their mind. And Xavier still found a way to win the game. So, I think Jones is a really good defender, but I don't know that it was a defensive error that was leading to Providence's scoring. They're the kind of team that you want to walk away from a lot of their players at the 3-point line. And those guys just happened to be hitting on Sunday. So our final wrap up question, and given that we are all Cleveland fans and a lot of Xavier's fan base is Cincinnati fans, I thought I'd find something that could bring us all together. So what is you guys's best moment of sporting Schadenfreude, and why is it the ball sailing over Ben Roethlisberger's head and into the end zone on Sunday night on the first play of the game, which was hilarious? Brad, go ahead.
My favorite moment of that is when Marquise Pouncey snapped the ball over Ben Roethlisberger's head on the first play of a playoff game. My favorite part of that favorite moment was Roethlisberger getting back there, looking at the football, looking at the Steelers guy next to him, and then thinking, nah, I'm not going to flop on this thing. It just seems like way too much effort. And Myles Garrett came diving in, and then the Browns scored a touchdown while Roethlisberger still just stood there, kind of Cam Newton staring at a ball on the ground.
Okay, but is there another moment that cracked you up because it was a bad thing happening to someone you can't stand in a sporting event? Braden, there are lots of people who you can't stand, so why don't you go ahead?
For me personally, it was the tournament back in 2014 when Ohio State was playing UD. This was a no-win situation in my mind. I hate both of those teams with a burning passion. But I specifically hated Aaron Kraft of Ohio State, because the media just absolutely lapped it up on him. He was a high IQ player, you know, high motor guy, coach's son, all the cliches they throw at you when you're not very athletic and short. But all the time he made the right play according to everyone, and racing up the floor down one, I believe, against UD, he decided he was going to look off two of the best 3-point shooters in the Big Ten and attempt a floater over two bigs in the lane. Not really taking off one foot, he kind of like tripped, stumbled in the lane and flipped the ball up and it missed. And I'll tell you what, I lapped it up. I loved that. I absolutely no shame in my game of hating Aaron Kraft. And I watch that tape probably on a daily basis. I don't know what that says about me, but I don't really care either.
What about Octavius Ellis going for the dunk and holding on to the ball way too long and time running out, then him dunking what he thought was a game winner in the tournament, but it turned out time had just expired with the ball still in his hand. That was a good one, too. I enjoyed that thoroughly. Still not as funny to me, and maybe this is recency bias, though, as the look on Ben Roethlisberger's face while the ball went sailing over his head.
That's right. Yeah, I got scientific here because I was like, who do I really not like in a sports sense? And I came up with two people who I think go over the top as far as me not liking them. The first is Jordan Pickford, who, super easy to hate. And so just from a purely it made me happy because something bad happened to him standpoint, I have to say it was the time he tipped the ball back into play against Liverpool for them to score the easiest game-winning goal of all time, which was really funny. Because he's made moronic plays against teams I liked, but just from a purely it made me happy because it was bad happening to him, it had to be a team I'm pretty neutral on. The other one, though, I'm going to the 2015 NCAA tournament. This is funny. It's NCAA tournament in three consecutive years. It's three different moments. This came in the Final Four when John Calipari, who is my least favorite person in college basketball, had a 38-0 Kentucky team in the Final Four. Everybody was like, is this the best team ever? And it turns out they weren't even the best team in their national semifinal because Wisconsin beat them. Aaron Harrison chucked an air ball. It was hilarious. It was super funny to watch all the Kentucky fans melt down because not only were they not the best team ever, they weren't even going to win the national championship. They weren't going to go undefeated. They weren't even going to go to the title game. It was really funny. And then after the game, Calipari did lots of whining about the refs, how hard their bracket had been, anything you could think of. I loved it. I absolutely adored it. So anyway, we're all pretty small people and we own up to that. We're okay with it. So if you guys are like, well, you guys sound hateful. We are hateful. So thank you for noticing. Anyway, that is it for this week. Xavier's going to be back in action this Saturday at 3:30 on CBS Sports Network. So the seven of you who actually have that network, enjoy that game. Xavier's at home against Seton Hall, or at Seton Hall, actually, trying to avenge their home loss and keep the winning streak for the away team going in that series. I believe it's up to five or six now straight games between Xavier and Seton Hall where the away teams won. So Xavier will try and keep that going on Saturday. And we will see if Sandro Mamukelashvili has grown a mustache to go with his beard yet. But anyway, I actually like him, but he does need to grow a mustache to go with that beard. Anyway, that is it from us. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we will catch you next week.